Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Monday, May 16th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. And here's our first story. USPS pauses moving center by Gretchen Teske. Mail distribution may still move out of the Quad Cities, but not until 2025. In early April, the United States Postal Service announced plans to move ahead with the decision to drop the distribution center in Milan and move it to Des Moines. The Milan center would continue to be open and used as a processing center rather than both a distribution and processing center under the new plan. Now, the USPS says, that plan is being put on pause. In a May 9th letter to Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee Chairman Gary Peters, a Democrat from Michigan, Postmaster General Louis DeJoy acknowledged receiving letters from elected officials who are concerned about the mail processing facility reviews ongoing at about 60 of 427 processing plants. DeJoy said in the letter, the plans were not meant to hinder communities by taking away jobs, but instead improve the USPS system as a whole by upgrading equipment and facilities while saving money. I acknowledge we have not been able to convince Congress of this, even though these efforts will both improve facilities and facilitate the significant cost reductions that we absolutely must achieve to have any hope of financial stability, he said. DeJoy continued that he felt the misconceptions were a result of the USPS closing facilities in the past under a different strategy. Referencing a previous conversation with Peters, DeJoy wrote that he agreed to pause the movement of processing facilities until at least January 1st of 2025. Congressman Eric Sorensen of Illinois 17, said in a statement he was one of many elected officials who sent letters to DeJoy expressing concern about moving the facility out of Milan. The pause is a success in his eyes. The Milan Processing and Distribution Center provides essential services for communities in northwestern Illinois, and any action that would put local jobs at risk or diminish customer service is unacceptable, he said. I will continue to work to protect jobs in Milan and ensure that our neighbors receive their mail on time. As previously reported, the plan outlined for the Quad Cities includes diverting mail to Des Moines to be processed and have it driven into the Quad Cities daily in the name of cost savings. In April, documents showed the changes were expected to save the facility between $970,000 and $1.3 million a year. No career layoffs in the local workforce were anticipated, though USPS was planning to transfer positions. In February, nearly two dozen postal workers attended the presentation of the proposed change and spoke out against the change during public comment at a meeting on the topic. Many felt like the USPS was downplaying the fact that employees would be moved out of the facility and were worried about the lack of preparedness the Des Moines facility might face. Postal worker Muriel Weeks was one of many who questioned if the Des Moines facility would be able to handle Quad City's mail on top of what it already handles daily. The mail is already late coming out of Des Moines. They seem like they are understaffed or overworked, she said in February. Us adding the burden of our mail to their facility is not going to make mail delivery more efficient. It's going to slow it down.
All right, Duchess and Countess scrapped. Petition to Preserve American Queen Gains Steam by David Hartley. While a petition to preserve the American Queen paddle wheel steamship gathers signatures, American Cruise Lines reported the American Duchess and the American Countess have been scrapped. According to a report from Cruise Industry News, American Cruise Lines, which purchased the American Queen Cruise Lines fleet in bankruptcy auction in March, has confirmed the American Countess and the American Duchess have been scrapped. It also said that the American Queen continues to be evaluated. There has been no word about plans for the American Empress ship, which is based in the Pacific Northwest. American Cruise Lines remains focused on modernizing and elevating the domestic cruise industry with new ships, large staterooms, modern technology, and rigorous environmental standards, the company said in a statement. We have recycled the former AQV vessels, Countess and Duchess. We continue to evaluate options for the Queen, including the possibility of donating to a municipal or nonprofit entity. The American Queen has a capacity for 436 guests in 222 staterooms and is believed to be the largest river steamship ever built. It was constructed in 1994 for Delta Queen Cruise Lines and was later retired in 2008. American Queen Cruise Lines, a subsidiary of HMS Global Maritime, bought the ship in 2011. Meanwhile, the Muscatine-based petition to save the American Queen continues. Mark Washburn started the petition on change.org, asking American Cruise Lines, the new owner of the ship, which now features Muscatine as one of its stops, not to decommission it. The petition can be signed at https://www.change.org/p/save-the-American-Queen-Riverboat. Washburn also said that the people can send letters to American Cruise Lines asking the ship to remain in operation. As of Wednesday morning, the petition had 846 signatures. Photos of the American Queen or the American Empress do not appear on the American Cruise Lines website with the Mississippi Fleet.
Downsizing North Park Mall Recommended by Sarah Watson. A new report by a city-hired consultant recommends demolishing an underused portion of North Park Mall and encouraging new entertainment and housing developments. As retail shifts away from traditional malls across the country, Davenport, working with Mace Rich, the largest landowner at the mall, has sought out ways to prepare North Park Mall for potential redevelopment. Leland Consulting Group, which the city hired for $100,000 in August of 2023 to perform a market study and make recommendations for the city, and Masrich presented a high-level overview of recommendations to the Davenport City Council Tuesday afternoon. The three core recommendations by the group were to reduce the retail space in the mall to adjust to the market, make it a community destination with a sense of place that attracts people to it, and activate the area with new uses that complement the retail, such as events. Among the recommendations were reducing the size of North Park Mall by about 300,000 square feet to stem the tide of retailers leaving. The report recommends the demolition of the former Sears and the corridor leading up to it. The proposed plan would leave Von Maur in place. Most recently, the former Sears housed a temporary Dick's Sporting Goods location while the company remodeled its Elmore Avenue store into a new House of Sports model. During the pandemic, it was a state COVID-19 testing site. Once a mall reaches 25% to 30% vacancy, retail tenants can negotiate more favorable rent or the right to terminate their leases and walk away because of decreased foot traffic, according to David Greensfelder, managing principal of Greensfelder Commercial Real Estate and one of the consultants on the project. North Park is close to this inflection point, Greensfelder said, and the thing that's important to know is once the dominoes fall, it's almost impossible to set the dominoes back up again. A smaller mall would mean a more favorable location for retailers to locate near one another, Greensfelder said. Plus, it opens up space for other non-retail investments, such as housing or entertainment, that create a sense of place and draw people in. Reducing the size of the mall would also reduce the number of owners, which Greensfelder said would reduce barriers and complications to redevelopment. The consultant's market analysis showed shoppers are migrating to the Elmore Avenue corridor when shopping for commodity goods, Greensfelder said, which are goods that are the same no matter where they are bought. Shoppers make decisions on where to buy commodity goods based on convenience and price, Greensfelder said, and right now the Elmore corridor is more convenient. Although the mall is slowly losing retail, the consultants emphasize the mall is not in such dire straits as other malls they've seen. North Park Mall opened on July 11, 1973, with 700,000 square feet of space, making the shopping center the largest enclosed mall in Iowa at the time. The original anchors were J.C. Penney, Yonkers, and Montgomery Ward, which closed in 2001 when the chain went out of business. It was replaced by Dillard's 2 years later. A multi-million-dollar expansion in 1981 brought Sears and Von Maur to the mall. Sears and Yonkers closed within months of each other in 2018, leaving behind thousands of square feet of empty retail space. Currently, Von Maur, Dillard's, and JCPenney remain. The mall is split up among owners, with Macerich being the largest owner. According to the company's 2023 annual report, 82% of Macerich's 399,000 square feet is leased in Davenport, meaning about 18% is vacant. That does not include the anchor properties. The total mall space is close to 1 million square feet. The consultants proposed high-level concepts for the North Park Mall that could include a mix of single and multifamily housing and public space to the north, and a focus on retail and entertainment opportunities on the south side of the mall. Zaha said there's population and employment growth in Davenport that shows the area could use about 350 housing units, which could be targeted toward a mix of the market, seniors, college students, early career individuals, and small families. Also, community events such as farmers markets, youth events, and reuse of retail space into performing arts, sports, or event facilities could activate the spaces where retail didn't stick around. Zahas praised the city for activation already underway. Davenport Junior Theater, a city and nonprofit-run theater program, is proposed to move temporarily into the former Yonkers as its current home, the Annie Wittenmeyer Complex, is eyed for a housing development. In other mall redevelopments, healthcare and higher education facilities are common suggestions, but Zaha said the market analysis showed those needs are already being met elsewhere in the community. Other mall developments have put in place amenities that draw people to it, such as outdoor community spaces and access to nature, street furniture and amenities, signage, and public art to evoke a sense of place. Zahas gave an example of Lakeside Mall in Sterling Heights, Michigan, near Detroit. At that mall, there is a planned 90% reduction in the total amount of retail square footage that will be replaced with housing and other land uses. Zahas said that project is being funded by a private developer, the city, and the state. He emphasized it took a long time. Although the project is breaking ground this summer, it took 10 years of planning ahead of time. Another example Zahas gave was Highland Mall in Texas, which was redeveloped with a community college as the new anchor instead of retail. That's a recurring theme of thinking about activating the site with other things, Zahas said. If the market doesn't support retail, what does it support, and what are the uses that we can identify that will draw people in the community to use it as a community asset? If not, or in addition to, perhaps more limited shopping. Zaha said it would be a key for the city and property owners to develop a more detailed master plan. Patrick Alvord, one of the consultants, said it would be vital for all parties to pursue public-private partnerships to make redevelopment happen. The key is to have an open and trusting relationship between public and private parties. Greenfelder emphasized that the private and public sectors needed to be willing to move forward together at the same time. One of the themes we heard was there's a lot of you go first. Should the city go first? Should the landowner go first? This needs to be a joint venture, Greenfelder said. Everyone linking arms and moving forward is one of the most important takeaways we can offer. Davenport Alderman on Tuesday urged their colleagues not to shelve the report once it's finalized. First Ward Alderman Rick Dunn asked the consultants who should be driving the bus to make sure the plan is enacted. He referenced a Rockingham Road corridor study that stalled. The consultants said ideally two people would be driving the bus, the mall owners and the city together. Seventh Ward Alderman Michaud Lynch requested that aldermen be heavily involved in the idea formation of what could go in at the mall, as it could be one of the largest revitalization projects in decades.
Election 2024. Early voting begins in Iowa primary. This is by Caleb McCullough and Tom Barton from League Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Iowa's June 4 primary election is right around the corner, and early voting began on Wednesday. Here's everything you need to know about voting in the primary election. Iowa has a closed primary election, which means voters must be registered with a Democratic or Republican party to participate. voters can change their party affiliation any time before the election day or at the polling place on election day. The primary election determines which candidates will be on the November 5 ballots for Democrats and Republicans in federal, legislative, and local races. How do I register to vote in the June primary? The deadline to register to vote ahead of the June 4 primary is May 20. You can check whether you're registered to vote at the Iowa Secretary of State's website. If you are not registered or need to update your information, you can register online at Iowa DOT website or print a voter registration form and bring it to your local county auditor. If you miss the deadline, you can still register to vote on Election Day. You must bring a valid photo ID and proof of residence if your photo ID does not contain your current address. How do I request an absentee ballot for the Iowa primary election? If you would like to mail your absentee ballot, you can request one until 5 p.m. on May 20. You can mail an absentee ballot request to your local county auditor or bring it there in person. Mailed absentee ballot requests must be received by the auditor on May 20th deadline. So if you want to be sure your request arrives, you can bring it in person. Forms can be found at your local county auditor's website or office. To receive an absentee ballot, a registered voter must provide the following: Iowa residential address, voter ID number. This can be your Iowa driver's license or a non-operator ID number or the four-digit voter PIN located on your Iowa voter ID card. Any voter may request an Iowa voter ID card by contacting the county auditor's office. The name or date of the election for which you are requesting an absentee ballot. Party affiliation. Signature and date the form was completed. You can keep track of your absentee ballot using a tool on the Iowa Secretary of State's website. How do I return my absentee ballot? You can return an absentee ballot by mail, at a ballot drop box, or by bringing it to your county auditor's office. Mailed absentee ballots must be received by the county auditor's office by the time polls close at 8 p.m. on June 4. Absentee ballots cannot be delivered to a polling place on Election Day. Voters can either deliver their absentee ballots to the county auditor's office before the polls close on Election Day, or surrender their absentee ballots at the polls and vote a regular ballot, or vote a provisional ballot at the polls if unable to surrender their voted absentee ballot. Can I vote early in person? You can vote early in person without mailing an absentee ballot request form. Early in-person voting is available between now and June 3, the Monday before the election. The early voting hours vary by county, but many county auditors offer early voting Monday through Friday at their office. Some counties offer satellite early voting locations. You will need the same information to vote early as you do for an absentee ballot, including your residential address and driver's license or voter ID number. How do I vote on Election Day? The primary election will be held on June 4. The polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. You can find your polling place at the Iowa Secretary of State's website or from your local auditor. Iowa requires voters to show a photo ID to vote on Election Day. If you do not have a valid ID, you can have another registered voter attest to your identity or provide proof of identity and residence using Election Day registration documents. Who is on the ballot in the primary election? Three of Iowa's four congressional districts have primary elections this year. Republican incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks, Republican incumbent Marionette Miller Meeks in Iowa's 1st District is challenged by Quad Cities prayer breakfast organizer David Potch. Incumbent GOP Representative Randy Feenstra, who represents the 4th District, is facing a primary challenge from Republican Kevin Virgil. Democrats Lannon Beckham and Melissa Vine are facing off to challenge Republican incumbent Representative Zach Nunn in Iowa's 3rd District. There are many other private races for seats in the state legislature and for local county supervisors and sheriffs. You can find sample ballots for your local races at your county auditor's website. There are no statewide primary elections this year. The governor and other statewide executives aren't on the ballot until 2026, and neither of Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst is up for re-election.
Toy Box Exhibit set to open. John Deere Pavilion exhibit to feature new toys over time. This is by Gretchen Teske. A new exhibit is coming to the John Deere Pavilion in Moline this week. From the Toy Box, a century of John Deere toys, will officially be unveiled Friday inside the pavilion at 1400 River Drive in Moline. The permanent addition will feature new toys over time and a toy of the month for purchase at the neighboring John Deere store. The idea to feature toys stemmed from conversations with collectors about their favorite John Deere-made items and how to feature them. We hear from collectors especially about John Deere toys all the time, and so we started talking about the pavilion and maybe some ways to get more equipment in there, said Neil Dahlstrom, branded properties and heritage manager for John Deere. The equipment continuously gets bigger, but the building's footprint stays the same. The Deere team started brainstorming new ways to represent the brand by showcasing items that have meaning to people, Dahlstrom said. We've got hundreds of toys in our archive collection, and we really wanted to get some of those out so they could be seen, he said. As he looked closer, he realized the criteria was different for each collector. Some were basing their evaluation on financial value, some on sentimental value. Each person had a different reason for selecting the toy they did. We were really interested in this idea that each toy has a different meaning for different people, he said. It became something almost very simple. Toys are one thing every generation can share stories about, he said. The new exhibit will be a new addition to the pavilion, and all other tractors on display will remain. The exhibit will be interactive and immersive, Dahlstrom said, with the toys displayed inside a massive modern-day John Deere toy box. Visitors can walk inside. On top will be another toy box, this one a replica of a mid-1960s John Deere toy box. Inside the exhibit will be a large case showcasing more than 40 toys, ranging from a wagon from 1912 to a pedal tractor from the 1960s to the John Deere Barbie released in 2007. That list was slowly whittled down from 100, he said, and picked to show the diversity of the toys offered by Deere. There's a lot of evolution, and one of the themes is just toys have always been toys, Dahlstrom said. We wanted to create this vehicle for people to have this moment. That's truly what it's all about. The John Deere Pavilion is open from 1 to 5 p.m. on Mondays and 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday with free admission every day. And it's got a couple pictures here of workers from Edwards Creative who are installing this new display, Toy Box, a Century of John Deere's Toys. And Austin DeCoster is one of the workers who is working on the new exhibit.
Okay, also from local news, Milan police investigate armed robbery by Tom Louie. Milan police continue to search for the two men who robbed a Walgreens at gunpoint. Officers were dispatched at 9:58 p.m. Sunday to the Walgreens at 440 10th Avenue West in reference to a robbery. According to a news release, employees told officers two men dressed in all black clothing and wearing black ski masks entered the store near closing time and demanded money. The police said a firearm was displayed during the robbery and the men left with undisclosed amount of cash. Investigators determined the men left the scene in a stolen vehicle that was later recovered. The vehicle is being processed for evidence, according to the news release. Investigators also secured surveillance footage from the scene. Milan Chief of Police Christopher Johnson confirmed Wednesday the investigation is ongoing. Anyone with information related to the robbery is asked to contact the Milan Police Department Investigations Division at 309-787-8516.
I'm going to read just a few of the briefs before we go to the obituaries today. This is the national briefs. At the border, arrests for illegally crossing the U.S. border from Mexico fell more than 6% in April to the fourth lowest month of the Biden administration, authorities said Wednesday, bucking the usual spring increase. Bridge collapse. The electrical blackouts on the container ship Dolly before it left Baltimore's port were mechanically distinct from those that resulted in the deadly collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge hours later on March 26, according to congressional testimony Wednesday. Protest. Pro-Palestinian protesters wearing masks pitched tents and placed fake bloody corpses outside the home of a University of Michigan board member on Wednesday. Bus crash. Brian McLean Howard, 41, who has a long record of dangerous driving, told investigators he smoked marijuana oil and took prescription drugs hours before he sideswiped a bus, an arrest report unsealed Wednesday said. He pleaded not guilty to driving under the influence, manslaughter, in Tuesday's crash that killed 8 Mexican farm workers and injured dozens. Gag order. Donald Trump's lawyers asked New York's highest court to intervene Wednesday in his fight over a gag order that bars him from commenting on witnesses, jurors, and others in his hush money criminal trial. And resignation. Interior Department staffer Lily Greenberg Call on Wednesday became the first Jewish political appointee to publicly resign in protest to support of U.S.'s support for Israel's war in Gaza. And Netanyahu criticized over post-war planning. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fended off criticism Wednesday that he is not planning for a post-war reality in the Gaza Strip, saying it was impossible to prepare for any scenario until Hamas militants are defeated. He indicated Israel seeks to maintain control over security affairs and rejected a role for the internationally recognized Palestinian Authority. In contrast, the Biden administration wants Palestinian governance in Gaza and the Israeli-occupied West Bank as a precursor to Palestinian statehood. Fighting erupted again in places Israel targeted in the early days of the war and in Gaza's southern city of Rafah, which sent hundreds of thousands fleeing. For Palestinians, that renewed painful memories of mass expulsion from what is now Israel in the war surrounding the country's creation in 1948. They marked the 76th anniversary of that event Wednesday. And finally, Ukraine's troops pull back from some areas. Ukrainian forces withdrew from some parts of the country's northeast and battled Russian troops in other areas Wednesday. President Vladimir Zelensky postponed all his upcoming foreign trips, underscoring the seriousness of the threat his soldiers face. Against that grim backdrop, visiting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sought to reassure Ukraine of continuing American support, announcing a $2 billion arms deal. Most of the money comes from a package approved last month. Russia's President Vladimir Putin landed Thursday in Beijing for a two-day state visit to China after saying the Kremlin is prepared to negotiate over the conflict in Ukraine. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries.
Bruce B. Hokanson, August 30, 1932, May 9, 2024. Bruce B. Hokanson, 91, of Bettendorf, Iowa, passed away Thursday, May 9th, at his home. There will be a celebration of life held Thursday, June 30th, at 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory, Davenport, Iowa. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society, and you can share condolences with the family at www.rungmortuary.com. Bruce was born August 30, 1932, in Ottumwa, Iowa, to Guy and Helen Jones Hokanson. He served in the U.S. Army during the Korean conflict. Bruce has been employed at Castle Excavating Bettendorf as an estimator for 40-plus years prior to his retirement. After drive school bus for the Pleasant Valley school system for 10 years until he retired a second time. And earlier in life, he had enjoyed clogging, swing dancing, roller skating, bowling, ran in the Bix in his 60s, and was just mowing his yard last week. Those left to honor his memory include his daughter, Stacy, and her husband, Joseph Fennell, in Hobbsville, North Carolina, grandchildren Jack and wife Erica Henry of Chesapeake, Virginia, Savannah, husband Matthew Cody of Clinton, Massachusetts, and Johanna and husband Edward Copeland of Columbus, South Carolina, great-grandchildren Isabella and Carmine Henry. Bruce was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Robert, James, and Val Hokanson, and sister Donna Mae Fellman. Joanne L. Jojo Schutte. That is spelled S-C-H-U-T-T-E. June 20th, 1953 to May 7, 2024. Joanne L. Jojo Schutte, 70, of Davenport, passed away on Tuesday, May 7th, at her residence. A celebration of life will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, May 19th, at the Adventure Church in Davenport. Interment will be at Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Joanne was born on June 2, 1953. On December 16, 1972, she married Richard W. Dick Schutte in Davenport. She worked for over 10 years at Slago Foods in Davenport. Joanne was a sister, wife, mother, aunt, but most importantly, a grandmother. Her grandchildren were the light of her life, and she loved spending time with each of them. Those left to honor her memory are her son Dennis, wife Angela Schutte of Davenport, and Donald and wife Ron Schutte of East Moline. Five grandchildren, Jolene McKittrick, Dante Berchtold, Brody Schutte, Ryland Schutte, and Zoe Schutte, and several brothers and sisters. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband Dick and two sisters. Online condolences may be shared with Joanne's family at www.mcginnis-chambers.com. Beverly J. Levitzo, June 22, 1933 to May 15, 2024. Betty J. Levitzo, 90, of Davenport, Iowa, passed away Wednesday, May 15th. Services will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, May 18th, at the Rungi Mortuary Chapel. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m., and she will be laid to rest in Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be expressed at www.rungimortuary.com. Betty was born June 22, 1933. The daughter of Walter and Maida Seifert King in Oxford Junction, Iowa. On October 20, 1951, she was united in marriage to Ralph Levitzo in Davenport. They celebrated 67 years of marriage until his passing in 2019. She retired from Mercy Hospital in 1993. Those left to honor her memory are all of her nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, beloved husband Ralph, sister Alveda Woods, and brother Laverne King. The family would like to thank the staff at Silvercrest Assisted Living for the compassionate care of Betty. Harmon Charles Conklin, August 12, 1940, May 14, 2024. Carmen Charles Conklin, age 83, of Bluegrass, passed away on Tuesday, May 14th at his home. Services will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, May 17th at Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home in Davenport. The family will greet friends from 10 a.m. until the time of service. Burial will be in Rose Hill Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family or St. Jude's. Carmen was born on August 12, 1940, in Davenport to Bernard and Angelus Catherine Williams Conklin. He was united in marriage to Ellen Letts on July 12, 1978, in Las Vegas. Carmen first worked for the city of Davenport as a fireman from 1967 to 1980. He then went on to become a journeyman plumber for 26 years, where he retired in 2005. Carmen was very generous with his time, which showed his love for being father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. He loved being around people, telling his jokes, and being the life of the party. He looked forward to vacationing with his family and watching the Hawkeyes with them and his friends. Survivors include his wife Ellen, son Darren Conklin of Davenport, daughters Lori, husband Dave Owens, Tracy, husband Bobby Blake, and Michelle, husband Seth Corver, all of Davenport, 7 grandchildren, 7 great-grandchildren, and a brother, Terry, wife Sandy Conklin of Davenport, and nieces and nephews. In addition to his parents, Carmen was preceded in death by a sister, Dolores Tovere, brothers Donnie Conklin, Curtis Conklin, and David Conklin. The family asks that you wear casual attire or your favorite Hawkeye clothing. Online condolences may be made to the family by visiting his obituary at www.hmdfuneralhome.com. Melvin L. Schroeder, June 8, 1939 to May 13, 2024. Melvin L. Schroeder, 84, of DeWitt, Iowa, passed away on Monday morning, May 13th, at the Genesis Medical Center, East Campus in Davenport, Iowa. A private burial will be held at the Rock Island Memorial Park Cemetery. The family has honored his wishes, and cremation rites have been provided by Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. Melvin Lawrence Schroeder was born on June 8, 1939, in Rock Island, Illinois, the fourth child born to Arthur and Rosella Mae Kelly Schroeder. He grew up in Rock Island and Moline, Illinois. He later moved to Maquoketa, Iowa, and lastly was a resident at Fieldstone of DeWitt, Iowa. Melvin was an avid writer. He especially enjoyed writing his daily journal, letters to the editor, and poems. He looked forward every year to baseball season and attending the Clinton Lumberjack Games. Those left to honor his memory include several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, 3 brothers, Harold, Reverend Ivan, and Jerry, and 3 sisters, Lois, Loretta, and infant Catherine. The family would like to give special thanks to the Genesis Medical Center East Campus 6th floor nurses and staff, and to the staff at Fieldstone in DeWitt. Memorials may be given to your favorite charity. Online condolences may be left at www.carsonandson.com. Steve Carl Fowler, October 4, 1948, May 11, 2024. Stephen Steve Carl Fowler, 75, of Montpelier, passed away Sunday, May 11, 2024, at the University of Iowa Hospitals with his family by his side. Visitation will be Friday, May 17th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Wirtz Funeral Home. Funeral service will be on Saturday, May 18th at 10 a.m. at Wirtz Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 9 a.m. until time of service. Burial will be at Davenport Memorial Park following the service. Steve was born on October 1948 in Davenport, Iowa, to Carl and Laverne Fowler. He was a very smart man and went to work at an early age, but still went on to earn his GED. He fell in love with Susan Graves, and they were united in marriage on March 4, 1967. Steve started working with the railroad at an early age and went on to work as a meat cutter. He was co-founder of Steve's Meat Shop. Steve loved his friends and family dearly. He played just as hard as he worked. Steve never fully retired, as his job was fun and he loved making people happy with food. Steve was truly a friend to all he met. He is survived by his son, Michael, wife, Patricia Fowler, grandsons, Stephen Fowler, Alexander Fowler, brothers, Stanley, wife, Tracy Fowler, Marvin, wife, Donna Fowler, brothers and sisters-in-law, Chris Flick, Kathy, husband, Jim Graft, Keenan, wife, Sheila Graves, Patty, husband, Eric DePorter, Ted, wife, Jesse Graves, and Debbie, husband, Dennis Driscoll. Many nieces and nephews, extended family. Greg Fowler, Kevin Fowler, Paul Barn family, Lester Lobdell, Aubie Sint, Danny Sint, Lynn Sint, Uncle Larry Sint, Jamie Laudell, and Tom Peterson. He was preceded in death by his wife Susan, parents, son Stephen Carl Fowler II, and his sister Marcia Cottrell. Online condolences may be made to his family by visiting www.wertz.com.
Okay, now we're going to turn to the opinions section. Well, first is our Another View column from the Chicago Tribune. Apple's ad confirms our many fears. Technology should be subservient partner to human creativity, not other way around. Apple last week released the worst advertisement in its long and previously illustrious history of brand creation, extension, and promotion. Why? The ad stupidly and arrogantly says the quiet part out loud. It does not so much sell an iPad as evoke discomfort at just what artificial intelligence might do to all of us sentient beings. In two words, crush us. In the advertisement, we see a malevolent force squeezing the life out of a trumpet, cans of paint, a camera lens, a guitar, a piano, a metronome, books, a sculpture, even a fun little kitty creature whose eyes are literally popped out of its sockets. And what is that force? A new iPad that happens to be thinner than the rest. Whoop-de-doo. Here is this kind of misstep that surely would have sent Apple founder Steve Jobs into a fury and is sufficient to suggest a company that has forgotten its roots as a fantastic tool for left-brain humans. Apple has always sold itself as a brilliantly curated collection of devices that humanize technology. In so doing, it revolutionized the creativity of architects, fashion designers, musicians, movie makers, and visual artists, and empowered all those in any field who were intimidated by MS-DOS and code. Instead of A drives and crucial colons, we got folders that looked like the ones on our messy desks. We removed files by throwing them in a friendly trash can. A familiar piece of fruit welcomed us to our work. Going to one of Apple's stores felt like going to a beautiful art gallery with precious works on display. More important, Apple positioned itself as a subservient partner to human creativity. It offered tools to amplify what we did. It made our work better and yet didn't require credit. In return, the world has showered the company with affection, happily paying premium prices for its products. How does it now see itself? The advertisement titled Crush might just tell you all you need to know. What Apple and other tech companies are failing to appreciate is that we're actually in a moment comparable to that of the 1980s, when computing first entered people's homes. The new world of AI is terrifying to many of us. We're fully aware that it is being trained by purloining content generated by people previously oblivious. We know it might come for our jobs one day. We worry what it will do to our children. Our fear is that it will morph from helper to dictator and, even worse, bring about some kind of new reality that's half human and half virtual, making it difficult for many of us to know the difference. Apple's marketers should be calming those fears, as should Google, Microsoft, and the rest. What does Apple do instead? Come out with an ad that crushes each and every human creative tool. It's brutal to watch, and our response, frankly, was visceral. We'd like to see a few phones and iPads under that crusher.
unfinished business. Lancers have unfinished business. 10 North Scott athlete qualified for state. The North Scott boys track team. Solid finish at last Thursday's Class 4A state qualifying meet in Cedar Rapids. 10 Lancers qualified for the state meet, which starts Thursday at Drake University in Des Moines. "We had a pretty good night," North Scott head coach Joe Greenwood said. "The whole goal of that meet is to get people qualified for the state. I feel like we accomplished our goals." One of 10 senior Colton Vos will participate in a team high 4 events. "Colton is a kid who has been big for us," Greenwood said. "He is a real motivated kid. Vos has been fighting some injuries this year, and just before our conference meet, he got himself healthy. He is returning from winning 4 medals last year and looking to improve on that this year." Senior Zach McMillan is one of 5 other Lancers who will be in multiple events. McMillan's 190-foot throw was the best in the discus at state qualifying, and his 52-foot 5-inch toss was also top throw in the shot put. "McMillan is our top thrower for us," Greenwood said. "He reset his own school record in the discus, so that was pretty good night for him." Senior Lowen Kruger had the 3rd fastest run in the 110 hurdles and anchored the 2nd place 400 relay unit. "Lowen has been a varsity athlete for us since he was a freshman," Greenwood said. "He has had a pretty good season with us." North Scott finished tied for 16th at last year's state meet. Greenwood believes his team can shoot even higher this time. "We talked about the fact that we still have some unfinished business here, and we are going to go out there with the attitude that we are going to compete." Now let me get to page 5 here. "We are going to compete. It's the best we can," he said. "It is no longer just go out there and run one time and go home. We have bigger aspirations than that. Every one of the 10 guys has a chance to bring home a medal, and I truly believe that."
And that was the Iowa boys track and field. We'll go to the Illinois boys track and field, Class 3A sectional. Panthers win title. Senior Corey Randall wins triple jump and long jump events by Samir Mala. For the first time in program history, United Township won the boys Class 3A track and field sectional title. The Panthers' 86-point performance Wednesday at Moline's Browning Park continued what has been a stellar season for the Panthers. This was the first undefeated season in program history, which is pretty phenomenal, United Township head coach Evan Holzbach said. Corey Randall was a big reason why United Township beat the likes of Rock Island, Yorkville, and Bradley Bourbonnais in the precursor to next week's Illinois state meet at Eastern Illinois University. Randall won the triple jump and the long jump, becoming the school's first long jump sectional champion and 2nd triple jump sectional champion in the past 15 years. "Corey is a fantastic athlete," Holzbach said. "He started track as a sophomore. If he had started as a freshman and had that extra year, he could have qualified for state last year." Randall's 13.7-meter triple jump, 44 feet, 11.25 inches, narrowly defeated Yorkville sophomore Damian Blank Jr.'s 13.6, 44, and 7.5. Randall beat freshman Malachi Lee of Bradley Bourbonnais 6.69 to 5.52 for the long jump title. Neither field event was his best. Randall set PRs in both at last week's Western Big Six meet. "Setting PRs felt good last week because I did not set a PR in my long jump since the indoor season," Randall said. "The triple jump felt even better because that is not an event I do a lot." Randall's prior long jump record was 6.86 in the WB6 championship and before them at the St. Ambrose Indoor Classic on March 5th. His PR in the triple jump was 13.75. "That WB6 meet was a big night for us," Holzbach said. "Corey was coming off a little hamstring soreness that he had for 6 weeks, and we were trying to win meets and just making the most out of them. So even though it was limiting him at times, he pushed through it. But the week of our Geneseo invite, we just said, let's rest, let's have you come back fresh. And then you can see that fresh legs made for a great night of jumping." Randall will participate at state for the first time. "I feel great," Randall said. Last year, I messed up my jump at sectionals, so it feels good to have redemption. Randall acknowledged feeling sentimental as his career winds down. This is a bittersweet moment, Randall said. To be able to graduate is sweet, even though I'm leaving my team. Randall's sophomore teammate and cousin, Isaiah Navarette, who ran a leg United Township's second place 800 relay team, was happy to see a member of his family excel. I am really proud of Corey for qualifying for his events, Navarette said. He is very motivated. I motivate him to do his best, and he motivates me to be a great person overall. I am glad he did what he did. Randall also was a wide receiver and WB6 all-first-team cornerback for the United Township football team this past fall. He felt that the lower body strength he built during that time on the gridiron aided in his success in track and field. Football helped me build on my leg power, and it got me more explosive, Randall said. Randall has offers to play college football and is considering attending either Quincy University or North Central College. I got to find a place I really like and a place that fits me, he said. The senior is delighted about his Panthers' undefeated season on the track. We've been doing great all season, and it is the first time we have been undefeated, Randall said. We did a lot of good things and set a lot of PRs in a lot of events. I'm just so proud of this team.
One more sports article. Midwest Roundup on Wednesday. The White Sox blank national again. Chicago Corey Lee went 3-for-3 with an RBI. Garrett Crochet tossed 5 scoreless innings, and the Chicago White Sox topped the Washington Nationals 2-0 on Wednesday for their second straight shutout win. Tommy Pham and Andrew Benintendi each singled and doubled for last place Chicago. Pham drove in the White Sox's first run as they won their second straight series and improved 11-8 since a 3-22 start of the season. Crochet, 4-4, allowed 3 hits and left after 89 pitches, 56 for strikes. The 6'6" left-hander struck out 6 and matched his season high with 3 walks. It was kind of a grind, Crochet said. I put myself in a hole early on. It was like 25 or 26 pitches in the first, another 20-plus in the second, and in the third. Crochet worked out of a base-loaded jam in the third after he walked Ildemaro Vargas and Joey Meneses. With 2 outs, he escaped by striking out Keibert Ruiz. I threw a lot of high-stress pitches, and so it really kind of eliminated any opportunity I had to go to 6 innings today, Crochet said. The way that our bullpen's been going lately, as soon as I handed it off, I knew that it was kind of a win in the bag. Jared Schuster followed with 2 hitless innings. Jordan Leisure pitched a 1-2-3-8. Michael Kopech worked around 2 walks in the 9th, striking out 2 for the 5th. Chicago took a 1-0 lead in the bottom half of Pham's run, scoring double down the third base line. Lee's RBI single with 2 outs in the 6th, he made it 2-0. Cubs 7, Braves 1. Javier Assad pitched 6 shutout innings to help visiting Chicago avoid its first sweep of the season. Assad, 4-0, allowed 4 hits and walked 1 while matching a season high with 7 strikeouts. He lowered his ERA to 1.49 through 9 starts. Pete Crow Armstrong went 2-for-4 with a triple, 2 RBIs, and a run scored. And Seiya Suzuki and Mike Tuchman homered for the Cubs, who had 13 hits after mustering just 8 while being shut out in the first 2 games of the series. Brewers 10, Pirates 2. William Contreras went 3-for-5 with 4 RBIs, hit one of Milwaukee's 5 homers on Martin Perez in the blowout. The NL Central leading Brewers won 2 of 3 from the Pirates at home before beginning a season-long 9-game trip Friday at Houston. The Brewers tied a franchise record for homers off a single pitcher in 1 game. Gary Sanchez, Frelick, Joey Ortiz, and Jackson Curiel also homered off Perez, who gave up 11 hits and 9 runs before leaving with nobody out in the 6th inning. Mariners 4, Royals 2. Ty France homered for the second time in 3 games, and Brian Wu allowed 1 run over 5 1/3 innings for his first win. The Mariners took 2 of 3 from the Royals and have won 8 of their last 9 series. Yankees 4, Twins 0. Aaron Judge followed a 467-foot home run with three hard-hit doubles and drove in two runs for visiting New York. Marcus Stroman threw six scoreless innings for his first win in four starts as the Yankees kept up their decades-long dominance of the Twins. They improved to 118-44 against them since 2002. That's the best record by any major league club against any intra-league opponent over the 23-season span.
Good job with the sports, Dorothy. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowasradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.